Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to episode 2 of Diplomacy, Britain versus America. If you're hearing me now, then you are a lovely patron that decided to support this show, and for that I am so grateful. Last time we did a bit of scene setting. We examined how the British and American governments grappled with a range of crises, largely confined to the sensitive border region between America and Canada. As we also saw, though, Lord Melbourne's government in London and his Foreign Secretary Lord Palmerston were preoccupied with a developing crisis in the Ottoman Empire. Palmerston had to parry Russian efforts to take advantage of Turkish weakness, while also standing firm as the French supported the Egyptian rebels. His tenacity had paid off, and by late 1840, although relations with France were less than ideal, the Eastern Question had been successfully put on ice, granting Palmerston more freedom to consider relations with the burgeoning Republic across the Atlantic. We saw how Palmerston put a pin in American affairs while he dealt with the Eastern Question. So in this episode, we're going to return to spring 1840 to see how the Americans felt about being pushed to the side, and how this sense of frustration may have compelled New York authorities to take matters into their own hands and arrest Alexander McLeod and charge him with responsibility for the burning of the Caroline. Having been denied a fair hearing for so long, it seemed Americans were sick of waiting, but Martin Van Buren's administration was far from pleased, so let's take a look at how it all happened as I take you to spring 1840. As Palmerston had strived to balance Britain's interests in the developing Eastern crisis, matters in America did not sit still. Many Americans were still sore at Britain's unwillingness to grant any satisfaction after the destruction of the Caroline. By this point in spring 1840, Washington was still pressing for reparations for that act of December 1837. Yet the British remained silent, leaving those Americans who longed for justice with a bitter taste in their mouths. British readers, likely also distracted by the spectacle of the crumbling Ottoman Empire, may have had little attention to spare for the United States, but this didn't stop British newspapers from printing extracts from American papers to provide more information. For example, in an April 1840 edition of London newspaper The Globe, it carried an issue of the Boston Advertiser that spoke of the bitter fallout from the Caroline. It's useful to note certain themes and concerns highlighted throughout this extract. Few would have advocated war with Britain in the American side, but the sense that excessive concessions, such as dropping the issue of the Caroline altogether, would be damaging to American honour, were palpable. And these were sentiments that Palmerston himself would have recognised. Thus, in late April, the Boston Advertiser wrote on the Caroline that "The subject in dispute is too utterly contemptible to be made the cause of disturbing the friendly relations between the two countries, even for the shortest period of time. But it is said that national honour is at stake, that the parties cannot recede from their claims without disgrace. This language we hold to be ridiculous. National honour requires, in a conflict with a foreign government, the maintenance of the essential rights and substantial interests of the country, but it no more interdicts the amicable compromise of a claim, believing it to be well grounded, even at the expense of yielding some part of that claim, when it comes in conflict with a claim as confidently entertained by the adverse party, than individual honour in private life forbids a man from compromising a claim disputed by his neighbour without insisting upon his extreme right." Now, we've heard this concept of national honour bandied about before, but I think now would be a good time to address it. We can start by looking at this editorial and a few key points in particular. The first is this debate over what national honour actually meant, a question many people have spent a long time trying to decipher. The second is the comparison of international stately relations with the relations between gentlemen, and the awareness of a code of honour in both of these spheres. This is another point I've examined in my PhD research, and it seems highly likely that the sense of individual honour and the desire for respect and status therein was transferred from the person to the nation. Seeing honour in the nation was not a 19th century idea, but the French Revolution and the rise of nationalist ideas at the turn of the 19th century do seem to be the moment when national honour skyrocketed in importance. However, it's important we don't see this as a clean transition. Gentlemen still spoke of their personal honour for much of the 19th and 20th century, and in some states, notably in Germany, Russia, France, and the southern United States, duels were still a part of the process whereby gentlemen could gain satisfaction for an insult they had received. The transferal of honour was thus messy and incomplete because statesmen felt a sense of honour while they also identified their honour increasingly as bound up with the nation, and they applied similar principles when seeking satisfaction for an insult. Of course, a nation couldn't fight a duel to redeem damaged honour, but the use of violence to gain satisfaction can be seen in the use of war, though governments obviously had to engage in significant preparations if they planned on going to war for the sake of national honour. This ideology, of course, might appear completely alien and ridiculous to us now, where honour rarely, if ever, interferes with our lives, and governments no longer speak of national honour, but prefer to speak of national interests. But it is important to have this alien culture in the back of our minds as we examine this diplomacy, because it's certainly true that national honour made compromise far more difficult for the British and Americans in a culture where concessions might suggest weakness, and, so the belief went, invite rivals to strike or cause your allies to waver in their support of you. In an episode that we'll be releasing soon, that is utterly enormous in size, seriously, I think it's the biggest episode I've ever released, I'll present a more complete breakdown of national honour. So for those interested in further reading on the honour subject, please feel free to download the script of that, which of course you can get because it's on Patreon, and follow my footnotes. I should add though, and we're not going to spend too much time on national honour now, but I should add that the better we understand how national honour was regarded and used, the better we can understand why crises like these could escalate into all-out war. To go back to that Boston Advertiser article, compromise on points of national honour was possible so long as each party came to the negotiations with a healthy respect for the other, and no side was forced to agree to excessive concessions. Indeed, the Advertiser insisted that an idea of national honour which forbade any kind of compromise would make every conflicting claim between governments a source of interminable national hostility. But what to do when each side believed itself to be in the right? The Advertiser insisted that America's claim was a just one, clearly secured in our opinion by positive treaty, while noting that the British government and all the people of the British colonies believed their claim is unquestionable. Compromise would normally be the natural solution, yet in the case of the burning of the Caroline, as the Advertiser lamented, national honour, therefore, according to the notion above alluded to, imposes an insuperable objection to an adjustment. It compels each party to be its own umpire, and to insist on the other party being governed by its decision. One party must yield, and by the same rule this can be done only after the chances of war have been appealed to. If we cannot concede any part of our claim to the spirit of compromise and the love of peace, neither can Great Britain. The two parties, in this view of the matter, stand precisely in the same light. Great Britain can no more recede without dishonour, if there be anything in this idea, than we can. There was a palpable sense of despair to these considerations, as the Advertiser lamented that all idea of an adjustment at present is utterly hopeless. But something had to give, because to expect that Great Britain will be induced by argument or intimidation to abandon their whole claim is what no one in this country expects. An intractable dilemma was thus made more difficult by the thorny question of national honour, and the Boston Advertiser and in turn the London Globe recognised that neither side could reduce its claims without incurring dishonour. In such a way could the understanding of national honour complicate and frustrate Anglo-American relations, and rather than an isolated case, this was in fact representative of a pattern. But were the British really as sensitive on these points as the Boston Advertiser claimed? In fact, as we saw in the last episode, one of the major concerns the British had was that the US-Canadian border was in a state of flux. Yet this state of affairs didn't dampen the British determination to secure what was interpreted as its rights in the region. Britain's position as a first-rate world power meant that any spectacle of compromise would negatively affect other questions. In late April 1840, The Times commented on Some ugly symptoms of the manner in which our national interests and honour are likely to be treated under the name of a settlement of the Northwest boundary question so long at issue with the United States. It was observed with some indignation that if the truth and justice of that question were generally understood by Englishmen, it would be recognised as one which ought never to be tolerated by any British statesman. The Times then drove the point home, insisting that no such thing as a question upon the rights of the British boundary ought ever to be endured at all, and never would have been so if British ministers had known and firmly discharged their duty. This duty was to British interests and British honour, and it was the responsibility of the government to uphold them, so the charge could only pile additional pressure on Palmerston's office. Still, the distance of the theatre from British minds, the lack of clarity on its status, and the generally uninformed British public, meant that when Loyalists burned the Caroline and the Niagara River, in full view of Americans on New York's shores, there was some head-scratching over the legality of the act. How much of the Niagara River was under American sovereignty, and could Navy Island, where the Caroline had been attacked, be regarded as neutral British or American territory? If it was the latter, then had the British just attacked an American vessel on technically American land? I won't take this opportunity to explore ideas like international law, then in its infancy at this point, but it is worth noting what other British statesmen in Melbourne's cabinet thought of the Caroline incident. While it is true that Palmerston didn't respond to American requests for reparation for some time, he did delegate the issue to noted lawyer and MP John Campbell, who later served as Lord Chancellor, a post traditionally tasked with gauging legality in difficult circumstances, so yeah, he had been handed a short straw here. In this case, Campbell didn't mince his words. "The affair of the Caroline was much more difficult," he said, adding that even Lord Grey, a former Prime Minister, "thought we were quite wrong in what we had done," though Campbell then noted, "I was clearly of opinion that although she lay on the American side of the river when she was seized, we had a clear right to seize and destroy her, just as we might have taken a battery erected by the rebels on the American shore, the guns of which were fired against the Queen's troops on Navy Island. Naturally, of course, had British soldiers arrived in unquestionably American territory, seized American batteries and killed American soldiers to stop them supporting the Canadian rebels, an Anglo-American war would almost certainly have followed. For the British, what mattered was finding some kind of legal justification for what they had done, and it's significant both that some disagreement existed on the Caroline issue, and that Palmerston ignored those concerns for the moment while he dealt with European and Eastern affairs. Britain was also, arguably, operating on legal precedent, since according to the 1814 Treaty of Ghent, which ended the War of 1812, Britain was to have jurisdiction over the disputed border regions. Minor disputes with the US state of Maine, which bordered Canada, meant that the treaty was often invoked in previous decades, and it was to end this tradition and bring greater clarity to these disputes that the Americans decided they wanted a new settlement. For the British, the bright side of things might argue that if the disputed territories were properly handled, controversies like these, like the Caroline or like MacLeod, wouldn't keep cropping up, which occupied their attention and clearly irritated Palmerston. Of course, the idea of giving up any rights at all was controversial, so both sides had to tread carefully. The Caroline incident was anything but careful treading, and we can view it as a kind of turning point for each side, because clearly these incidents threatened peace and stability, with each new controversy souring Anglo-American relations further. In his analysis of British foreign policy during the period, Kenneth Byrne described Anglo-American relations in the preceding decades as a period of mutual growth and symbiotic cooperation, undermined by repeated border disputes which had never been satisfactorily settled. He also noted that strategic concerns played a key role because the British wanted to secure land communications over a road from New Brunswick to Quebec, which veered perilously close to the borders of Maine and New York. Similarly for the Americans, there was a need to secure potential invasion routes from those Canadian provinces in the event of war. And going back a bit further through the 1820s and early 1830s, efforts had been made to solve the problems through international arbitration, which the 1814 Treaty of Ghent had allowed for. Hilariously though, the Arbiter, the King of the Netherlands, was so confused and overwhelmed by the details provided by each party, and now you know how he felt, that he simply divided the claims down the middle. The Americans couldn't accept this ruling, made in 1831, and the border's status had been left in that state of flux since. Growing populations on both sides of the border, and the need to clarify who ruled where when legal disputes arose, meant that this border could not be ignored indefinitely. Yet it is a testament to see how low a priority it was, at least in Britain, that this period of uncertainty was allowed to reign for so long. This is all to say that so long as these legal disputes over the border region bubbled away in the background, London and Washington were perhaps only another Caroline incident away from a great confrontation which neither side really wanted, but which the ideology of national honour and the unwillingness to grant public concessions meant neither side could easily back down from. And then we come, of course, to the sequel to these unanswered American requests for reparation, when the inhabitants of New York took matters into their own hands and arrested Alexander McLeod for his role in destroying the Caroline, which resulted in an American death. As James Chambers, author of Palmerston, The People's Darling, wrote, "When a vainglorious Canadian called Alexander McLeod visited New York State, entered a tavern in a drunken state, infuriated the other customers with truthless boasts about his exploits as a militiaman on the night of the raid on the Caroline, he woke the next morning in a New York jail. This occurred in September 1840, but with the complications that accompanied both the difficulty in communications and Palmerston's preoccupation with Ottoman settlement, Britain took a surprisingly long time to address this escalation. In the meantime, America was itself distracted by a change of government, as Martin Van Buren's presidency ended in March 1841, and President William Harrison died in office after barely a month, resulting in a constitutional crisis, which was only resolved when Harrison's vice president, John Tyler, succeeded him in April. John Tyler was a firm advocate of states' rights, including where those states advocated slavery. This suggested by default that Tyler would support New York's efforts to obtain justice in its imprisonment of McLeod. Yet the arrival of another figure on the scene was arguably just as significant. In early 1841, William Seward became governor of New York. Yes, this is the same William Seward, or William Seward as I erroneously called him in the Trent affair, sorry about that, but this is the same guy who served as Secretary of State during that incident. But 20 years before, Seward prided himself not necessarily on his diplomatic acumen, but instead, as he himself put it, he was determined to maintain the judicial jurisdiction of this state, but also to conduct the prosecution with energy, but with fairness towards the accused. In short, by spring 1841, Britain would have to reckon with two firm proponents of states' rights, a concept which, by the way, they didn't fully understand and were unwilling to accept as an excuse for what they saw as Washington's inaction. These little details do admittedly add complicated layers to the later controversies, but they also help explain why crises like this were so difficult for London and Washington to solve. Into this confusing scene, we should welcome General Winfield Scott, a decorated American soldier who served as Commander-in-Chief of the US Army until his retirement in 1861, and who even tried running for president a few times without success. By this point in his career, General Scott was prolific in his efforts to defend American interests along the border, while also balancing the general desire Washington had for peace. Fortunately for this peace, General Scott got on well with Governor Seward in New York and served as an effective go-between for the government and that state. For instance, while trumpeting New York's relative freedom of action, Seward did agree with General Scott's request to mobilize the militia if war with Britain did occur, a reassuring message in Washington, since New York would likely serve as one of the major front lines in such a conflict. But General Scott could only do so much, and although McLeod's arrest is the most famous, New Yorkers had been searching for those responsible for the Caroline for some time before McLeod was found. Several of those arrested in the years 1838-40 were released owing to a lack of evidence, and McLeod's case could arguably fall into the same category, since his brother was adamant that, Alexander had been 4 miles from the Carolina fray when the offence had occurred. Still, after being arrested, released, and rearrested several times in autumn 1840, MacLeod was finally imprisoned in Lockport, New York. Though he was granted bail in mid-November 1840, since it was late at night, MacLeod elected to stay the night in his cell. As he continued to fall foul of New York law, the governor of Upper Canada caught wind of MacLeod's predicament, informing both the British ambassador, Henry Fox, in Washington, and the government in London shortly thereafter. For concerned New Yorkers on the ground in Lockport, though, rumour and rage did their magic, and a furious mob grew in size outside the Lockport courthouse, allegedly even aiming a 12-pound cannon at MacLeod's cell in a fit of rage. Faced with these pressures, the offer of bail was withdrawn, and MacLeod remained in prison, no doubt anxiously peering through the bars of his cell to see the shouts and condemnation of the mob outside. As one Canadian eyewitness recalled at the time, "The exhibition of mob rule at Lockport was severely condemned by a large section of the American press, but no action was taken against the offenders. At the same time, one cannot help feeling that the attempt of the Upper Canadian authorities to secure MacLeod's liberation in this way was singularly ill-advised." It was ill-advised because concerned Britons denied the American right to try him based on the idea that a man couldn't be held responsible for a nation's acts, but though they denied this, they still urged MacLeod to make bail, a paradox which both denied American jurisdiction and seemed to rely on it. At the same time, American authorities effectively washed their hands, claiming they had no right to interfere in New York's affairs, since the issue was one of states' rights. Once bail was rescinded, of course, the situation became more serious, and as MacLeod stared at the four walls of his cell for an indefinite period, news reached the floors of Congress of his predicament. The debates effectively echoed these sentiments, that though the British might protest, as the Caroline was a matter for New York's authorities, Washington couldn't interfere to dismiss the case, though some senators did express concern that Britain would interpret the execution of MacLeod as a casus belli against the whole country, whether New York was solely responsible or not. Indeed, this latter position was precisely the stand that Palmerston took once the paper trail reached Melbourne's government and Palmerston got to grips with the situation. And although Palmerston was made aware of MacLeod's status, it was Parliament that addressed the controversy first. On the 8th of February 1841, the Earl of Mountcashel, who had purchased a 1,000-acre estate in Canada the decade before, presented the case of MacLeod in the House of Lords. Disputing the American claims, the Earl insisted that MacLeod was innocent, that he had not been present during the burning of the Caroline, and that "The persons who came forward with the charge had made a false and unjust accusation." Mountcashel then made a significant argument in defence of a firm immediate policy of action. The MacLeod case was, in a public point of view, a matter of more importance than some individuals might suppose. And Mountcashel continued, "It was, in fact, very nearly connected with our honour as a nation, and he did hope and trust that the government would take active and energetic steps to assert, maintain and uphold the character of this great country." Mountcashel hoped that the government would not, by tamely submitting to insult and wrong, suffer the national character to sink into contempt. Contempt for the British character would be the result if it allowed one of its citizens to be wrongly executed by a foreign court, and Mountcashel also understood the American context, saying, "Looking to the hostile feelings that had been manifested in the United States, it was evident to him that if they did not take a dignified position, they would be trampled on, and on every occasion, insulted wherever they went." A dignified position, in other words a policy which didn't retreat, was essential in Mountcashel's view, because the rights of Britons overseas would be endangered if her rivals learned that Britain failed to defend their citizens. In short, Mountcashel urged, there would be no safety abroad for British subjects. Painting a grim picture of MacLeod's fate, Mountcashel was clear on the necessary course. He hoped, therefore, that government would exert themselves to the preservation of the valuable life of this worthy individual who was now suffering in a dungeon of the United States, and that they would fully vindicate the character of this country. The only way to vindicate the character of the country was to leverage Britain's military supremacy in the region and leverage the threat of war, if necessary. The Prime Minister's response was also worthy of note. Lord Melbourne recounted how MacLeod's freedom had been demanded, but that Washington had asserted that the matter entirely rested with the authorities of the state of New York, and that it was neither in the power nor the inclination of the federal government of America to interfere. This spoke to the constitutional complexity of the United States, a matter which neither British media nor statesmen accepted. While Melbourne couldn't spell out the government's policy, he could assure the Lords that they would take those measures which in their estimation would be calculated to secure the safety of Her Majesty's subjects and to vindicate the honour of the British nation. Indeed, Palmerston was on the case. The following day, on the 9th of February, the Foreign Secretary penned a stern letter to Ambassador Henry Fox in Washington, and it's worth quoting from it at length, since it really captures the mood of the moment. Palmerston wrote, "There never was a matter upon which all parties, Tory, Whig and Radical, were more entirely agreed, and if any harm should be done to MacLeod, the indignation and resentment of all England will be extreme. Mr. Van Buren should understand this, and that the British nation will never permit a British subject to be dealt with as the people of New York propose to deal with MacLeod without taking a signal revenge upon the offenders. MacLeod's execution would produce war, war immediate and frightful in its character, because it would be a war of retaliation and vengeance." Next, Palmerston expressed his frustration with Washington's claim that its hands were tied where New York's policy was concerned, as he continued, "It is impossible that Mr. Forsyth, the American Secretary of State, can wish to bring upon the two countries such a calamity, and we can have no doubt that he will prevent it. He must have the means of doing so, or else the Federal Union exists but in name. But I presume that if we tell Forsyth that in the event of MacLeod's execution we should make war upon the state of New York, he would reply that in such a case we should ipso facto be at war with the rest of the Union. But if that is so, the rest of the Union must have the means of preventing the state of New York from doing a thing which would involve the whole Union in a war with England." Bringing the point home still further, Palmerston recounted a conversation he had had with Stevenson, the American ambassador in London, to the effect that, "I have told him, speaking not officially but as a private friend, that if MacLeod is executed there must be war. He said he quite felt it, that he is aware that all parties have but one feeling on the subject, and he promised to write to the President, as well as officially, by today's post." Was the Foreign Secretary bluffing for effect? It seems unlikely, as Palmerston repeated the same sentiments to a colleague shortly afterwards, insisting that, "If they were to hang MacLeod, we could not stand it, and war would be the inevitable result." It was characteristic of Palmerston to take such a strong stand, and his colleagues were aware of this quirk in his personality, which made him so worrying to his cabinet during crises like these, and conversely, also made him so popular with the British public. Famed cricketer and diarist Charles Greville later recalled that, "The real difficulty arises from a conviction here that, in the case of MacLeod, we are in the right, and an equally strong conviction there that we are not, and the actual doubt on which side the truth lies." Greville also noted that, "In a similar case here to MacLeod, we should be obliged to try the man, and if convicted, nothing but a pardon could save him." Having consulted with legalistic friends, Greville concluded that, "These opinions casting such serious doubts on the question of right are at least enough to restrain indignation and beget caution." Clearly, Palmerston never got this memo. Instead, he proceeded as though moved by his own sense of justice, casting aside the question of right in favour of a quest for satisfaction, and as we saw above, totally rejecting any suggestion that Washington could do nothing to stop New York's decisions. Wilbur Jones makes the good point that Palmerston was empowered to act this way because of something which I and the Foreign Secretary alluded to earlier. In the first place, he knew that his case, though not watertight, was strong, and would receive support from all political sections in Britain. Secondly, he correctly assumed that the peace-loving Van Buren administration in America and Louis Philippe's government in France would hardly go to war on such an issue. As Jones also notes, the confrontation would grant Palmerston the opportunity to teach the United States a good lesson, which would put her in a properly chastened mood for the coming negotiations over the Maine boundary and other problems. But was Palmerston pushing too hard? Though he might loathe the excuse, Washington could not undo the Constitution and block New York's decisions simply because the Foreign Secretary wished it. Nor was New York likely to back down, finding itself insulated within that Constitution and with a destroyer of the Caroline, true or not, finally in its hands. There was also the matter of France, and while Palmerston was confident that the French wouldn't take advantage of this Anglo-American quarrel, he couldn't guarantee that the French wouldn't take advantage of a full-blown Anglo-American war. What that would look like, and whether French soldiers would realistically fight alongside their American ally again, is a question we can answer easily because we know how matters progressed, but considering the recent troubles with France, and Paris's apparently spiteful decision to stick it to Britain by supporting the Egyptian rebel against the Ottoman Sultan, there was at least reason to consider the worst-case scenario. Instead of doing this, though, Palmerston leveraged his ties to the British press to fire repeated salvos in America's direction. Of particular importance was the Morning Chronicle, then heavily influenced by Palmerston, who was said to have directed its policy and contributed to its columns. In fact, some of his peers even called Palmerston Viscount Chronicle in recognition of this influence he had over the Morning Chronicle, though it's unlikely they called him this to his face. In late March 1841, the Morning Chronicle quoted the New York Inquirer to the effect that MacLeod's detention had excited great indignation in England and aroused a war feeling, which would be difficult to overcome and cannot fail to have a very injurious effect upon American securities and credit. The Inquirer noted that the British press was loud in its denunciations of this country, and both parties in Parliament united in the opinion that it was a national affair involving the honour of the British nation. Condemning the policy of bluff, which the Inquirer accused Van Buren's administration of perpetuating, it was observed that if war should ensue, it would be because the administration of Martin Van Buren made a demand that it shrunk from enforcing. And although this policy was base, it was still more base for Washington not to place the country in a position to enforce, if necessary, that demand. In mid-April 1841, the Morning Chronicle could provide an update on MacLeod's fate from its Philadelphia correspondent, who lamented that a clerical error forced the postponement of MacLeod's trial until October, observing that the conferences at Washington between the British and American potentates regarding MacLeod's fate were conducted in a very amicable manner, with a tone that was generally of a pacific, liberal, and honourable character. It was nonetheless noted that British agents were firm in the maintenance of national honour. There it is again, national honour, and the professed determination of the British government to abide by its strict tenets. Hopefully you can now see why I'm so obsessed with the code of honour among nations, but to see how Palmerston continued to pursue it, and how the MacLeod crisis developed into spring 1841, we're going to have to wait until the next episode. And I hope you'll join me for that. But until then, my name is Zach, and this has been episode 2 of Diplomacy, Britain versus America. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this show, you wonderful patron, you. And I'll be seeing you all soon.